better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks. It's Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Coming to you once again from Hot Springs Village, Arkansas, high atop the Highway 7 Ridge Line from TSPN, the Survival Podcast Network headquarters. Today is Friday, January the 6th, 2012. This is episode 815 of the Survival Podcast. That means it's the first Friday of the new year. You probably were back to work for a week and ready to go home and enjoy your weekend. Hopefully we can be a part of it with you. Today represents the return of the listener call show. That's right, those who pick up their phone and mash some numbers. The numbers you want to mash to do this, 866-65-THINK, 866-65-THINK. You'll get a voicemail service where you can leave your question or comment in 2 minutes or less. A little advice to get on a show like this. One, know what you're going to say before you call. That will help you get your call in 2 minutes or less. Two, be quick, direct, and to the point. Don't yammer on. I hate to put it that way, but I can't put you on the air if you take 2 minutes to get to your 10-second question at the end. So, get the question in early. That'll make the details more relevant if you want to add some details. Also, make sure that you call from a relatively quiet area, and the best thing to do would be call from a landline or when you know you have good cellular signal. If you leave me a message like, Jack, I'm not going to be able to do that, or if you have the windows down in your car or are running a chainsaw or a lawnmower or standing next to someone doing it when you make a call, you're probably not going to get it on the air. One special note, don't be somebody on the air today whose question will be answered, and it was a great question, and I'll just say that person, I won't say which one of the callers it is, I don't want to embarrass anybody, but that person called back this week, asked a second question, whined and complained that their first question had not yet been answered, so they were willing to get beyond that. You know who you are, I won't point you out. And then they asked a question in a really sarcastic tone. I got the sarcasm. It doesn't work for a show like this. A two-way conversation is necessary when you're being really, really sarcastic. And when you hear who it wasn't, Carson from Canada has it called, you hear a sarcastic Carson is, you'll see how sarcastic this other person must have been. If you have a question, let's get to it, get to the point, and don't whine that your last question wasn't answered. I cannot get everyone on the air. It's impossible. And on that note, if you called last year, which is not that long ago, I realize, it's probably best if you'd like your call fielded to call back because I've pretty much cleaned everything out going back. I've kept stuff in November, but I don't know that it'll ever get used. It's just there as a backup. But that means that right now I've got basically open lines, not for a live call-in show like they do on the radio, but very, very much an opening. And I'd say the next 10 people that call over the next 5 days are probably going to end up on the air Friday next week. We have some great calls today, including from the one person I just picked on a little bit. We'll get to those in a second. Before we do, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsor. Sponsor of the day number one today, Fortress Defense Consultants. Hey, I tell you all the time you need ammo for your guns. You know what you need to go with that ammo? You need training. You need training, training, and training because you don't fall back to your highest level of training in a crisis. You fall back to your lowest level of training. They taught us that in the military. It was absolutely true then. It's absolutely true now. So make sure you get some good firearms training and good medical training to go along with it. One of the best places in the world you can do that is Fortress Defense Consultants up in Illinois. And if you don't want to go to Illinois, and I can understand why some people wouldn't want to go to Illinois, what you can do is you can call them and put together a group, let's say 5, 6, 7 guys with enough final range somewhere local in your area. They will bring the training to you. So it's not just go there or you can't go, right? It's not, I realize some of you guys might be have a challenges with travel. So, you know, talk to your friends at work. If you're in a gun club, whatever, the guys that you hunt with, say, hey, look, we all talk about this stuff, but why don't we get some really put together some really good training? Get in touch with Fortress Defense, and whatever you can dream up, they will put together for you. Next up today, we are going to talk to you about the Berkey Guy. Now, what are you going to get from the Berkey Guy? You can get Berkey water filtration systems, as shocking as that may be. I'll tell you what, though, there are a million places you can get a Berkey. There really are. I mean, when I went to like a Self-Reliance Expo, there was like 14 booths where they had Berkeys in it. Where did I tell anybody they should go get their Berkey when they came by? they should go over and see Jeff. And is that because he's a sponsor? Well, sure, but I'll tell you what the real reason is. And if Jeff ever stops being a sponsor, I don't think he ever will, but if he ever does, I'm going to give the same recommendation, go deal with him. Because I have seen for 3 years now that he takes care of his customers 110% of the time. And there's not many people in business I can say that about. He also has some other great stuff for your prepping needs. Check out his website at directive21.com. As always, the best way to visit our sponsors and know they're our sponsors, go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and choose the sponsors banner in the right-hand margin. Next up, remember, consider joining the Member Support Brigade. If you do that, you get exclusive content available only to members. You get discounts to 32 vendors, I think now. You get over $150 worth of ebooks for free. It's a great deal. $50 a year or $5 a month. You pick your billing frequency on how you want to do that. And if you're military, law enforcement, Peace Corps, active duty, or prior service, hey, get in touch with me first by email at jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. Give me the details of your service. I will send you a special military discount code. And with that, I've got the housekeeping wrapped up. We'll go ahead and take that first call today.
Hey, Jack, this is Top W. Cohn from the Forums in North Olmsted, Ohio. I've got a real-life example of why you should not plan on being the He-Man do-it-all in a crisis. One of my three part-time jobs was a ROTC instructor at the University of Akron. Back in October, the cadets and I were doing a road march. You know, the hero gear stuff, IBA, ACH, rubber ducks, 35-pound ruck, etc. Towards the end of the march, I stepped off a curb and rolled my ankle really bad. I went down, and when I got my breath back, I did the normal stupid Army guy thing and finished the ruck marks, attended classes, and drove myself to the ER. It was not broken, just sprained. After some protein prodding and x-rays, I was sent home with a script for some painkiller. When I got home, I found out that the power was out. I could not walk. I had crutches that I didn't know how to use. I was in a lot of pain, and I could not do anything to help. I tried to talk my wife through checking the fuse box, but could not explain exactly what to do. When the painkiller kicked in, I realized I was in no way going to be able to talk her through hooking up the generator. If I'd put together a book together with some photos and diagrams, or if we had tested the generator and set it up and practiced both of us doing that, this probably wouldn't have been a problem. But I'd left it at the "I'll do it, don't worry about it" thing. Well, not anymore. I was out of work from one job for about 2 months, and we made use of not having any credit card debt, and we used our food storage. I had some friends come over to church and help out with a few things, but overall, as I can say, is don't plan on doing it all yourself. Get ready to have somebody else to do it, because you rip your ankle up and give you some nice drugs, you're not going to think straight. Have some food storage on hand so you don't have to go to the store very often, and have an emergency fund. Thanks for all you do out here.
Well, wise words, and yet another example of a little miniature personal shit hit the fan event. And this stuff happens all the time to people all over the place. And I think the big thing that lets people stay in an apathetic state and allow these things to happen is that, generally speaking, since it only happened to you, there's other people that can help you out. You get some friends involved or whatever. But if we end up, even let's say not a personal, but something that's regional or neighborhood-wide, you could be quite a while before there's anybody to help you. And having everybody in the home know what to do and how to do it, it's extremely important. And I think one place that there's probably a big hole in a lot of households is does the woman of the house know how to operate the firearms? And I don't mean the one gun that you bought her that fits in her purse that she went to the range and shot. That's great. She pick up the shotgun. She pick up the rifle. Could she pick up everybody that lives in your home that's old enough to be responsible with a firearm in their hands? Should be able to pick up any gun that is kept in that house and run that gun. It's not that hard, and if you give them confidence, they'll be able to do it. Because I'll tell you what, we just found out, I don't know if you guys heard the story or not, there was a young woman, she was in her teens, with her baby. Her husband had died on Christmas or Christmas Eve or something like that. She was in Oklahoma, and she was on the phone with a 911 operator waiting for the police to show up. And, of course, police usually get there after the crime. And in this case, they got there after the crime was stopped by the homeowner. There was a guy pounding on every door of the house trying to get through the door. She said to the 911 operator, "Hey, I've got a gun." I bet she had two guns. But she said, "If he comes through that door, can I shoot him?" And the operator says, "I can't tell you it's okay to do that, but you do what you need to protect your baby." which I would have said, shoot the son of a bitch. I mean, honestly. But at least he didn't say something stupid like put the gun down, like when that grandma shot that dude that was in her closet in Texas. But anyway, she shot his ass dead. And when you shoot somebody in like home range, you know, ranges inside a house with a shotgun, they don't keep coming. They either die or they get damn close to death's door. And it's important that, you know, we understand limitations. And I think one of the big things, I know this is kind of not exactly what Top was talking about here, but we have a propensity, especially with our women, they go to the store and they want a little gun, right? They want a little gun. Well, bigger is better in the world of firearms. And that's, you know, the carry, you're always undergunned with your handgun. You really are. It's amazing how undergunned you just might be, because all undergunned means is, even if you do everything right, the threat could still continue to pose a threat long enough to injure or kill you. So there's been a lot of people shot by a guy that was mortally wounded because he didn't expire quickly enough. So shotguns and carbines are fight enders. So that's part of why I'm saying this. But then the little stuff too, like the generator and having documentation. I think documentation is one of the biggest holes, and even as organized as we're trying to be, I guarantee you there's things that I just do that my wife doesn't know how to do that should be documented with pictures and photographs. And we should actually go through it once or twice together, because it is easy to be taken out of commission. I think we're strong guys, military background, a lot of us, and hunting and fishing and chainsawing, and we just feel like we're tough, and that's fine until one thing happens. In this case, a twisted ankle. But, I mean, I've said it before. People say, well, why should I even worry about having, like, tree surgeons in my documentation package? If a tree falls on our house, I'm going to just get my chainsaw out. And, well, not if it fell through the roof and hit you in the face and blinded you or killed you. And now what's your wife going to run out there with the big steel or the big Husqvarna? See, we have to start thinking this, and this is a philosophy from the military, mind you. When a formation runs in PT, physical training, you run at what's considered the speed of the slowest man in the formation. So that, now, there's a point where somebody is too weak and they're holding everything too much back, and it is the military, and you say, you fall out, it's on you. But generally speaking, you run at a speed that a lot of people in that formation are capable of going much faster, especially over a 2 or 3 mile distance, which is kind of an average every day unless we're pushing it PT run in the military. So you run at the speed of the slowest man. We have to think about that in our homes. You know, we have to move at the speed of the weakest members of our household, because we can't leave them behind because they're our family. And this is really an important subject. So Top, first of all, thanks for your service to our country for I think at least 20 years. And thank you for your service to our youth by, you know, being an ROTC instructor. And thank you for your call and for being honest about your own limitations. Thanks a lot, man. And let's go on and take the next call.
Hey, Jack, it's Chris from Richmond, Duster 22 on the forum. Listen, I got a question about liquidating money in investments, 401ks, 529s, that sort of thing. Now, obviously, we plan for success as well as failure, so this would be an endgame move. But in your opinion, what do you see as signs when it would be time to start moving that out of liquid assets and turning into more tangible assets if the dollar's debased or devalued or becomes worth less, significantly less? Wondering what your thoughts on that would be, what the red flags would be for doing that, and what you would do with that money, if anything. Thanks. Have a great day. Happy New Year.
Well, it's a tough question to answer, but I would say that the answer is not right now. But let me give you a couple different concepts here. One, don't ever do it till you know what you're going to do with the money. It might be the case that we're in such a situation that what you're going to do with the money is put it in cash and hold it. And if that's what you're going to do, fine. But know what you're going to do with it before you yank it. Okay, so that's one of the first things. The second thing to understand is that when you're looking at these types of investments, 401ks, 529s, and what have you, they're not like MF Global. They're not your typical broadly traded brokerages that are highly at risk to being lost because the underlying brokerage itself falls apart. They're much more stable than that, and they would probably be subject to bailout if the underlying brokerage failed. right? So it's not about, if you lose money, you lose money. That's all well and good, but the Fed would probably fire up the presses and bail out if there was an individual failure. Now, if one falls, then you got to start looking at the rest of them and going, and start, this. That would be an indicator, right? So if, you know, let's say, I don't even want to say a company, because then you, like, somebody's going to say, Jack said, you know, so-and-so is going to fall. So let's say ABC Financial Inc., as a major manager of 401k, 401(3b), and 529a plans in the United States, and gets close to even the underlying brokerage failing, so that the assets in the accounts are actually still okay, but the money somehow is leaking out the sides. Again, similar to what happened with MF Global. That would be an indicator that there might be concerns all around. So that would be one, and that might be time to get the money out of that brokerage institution. So, but it's not really, really likely. The bigger concern is protecting the money inside the vehicle, right? So remember, a 529 is a vehicle. You can do almost anything you want with the money inside there, but you can't take it out unless it's for an approved education expense without interest and penalty. A 401k is a vehicle for tax deferment, but you can do almost anything within the options inside the account. So if your 401k has a cash option, and it should, and I know some don't, but if it does, then if you're worried about the stock market, you don't need to remove the money from the vehicle. You just need to move it within the vehicle to your cash fund, your money market fund or what have you, or to a safer option, whatever you feel safe at the time. So in most instances, leaving the money inside is the right way. Now, are there times to liquidate? Yeah, but they're probably not due to fear. Now, if we ever get to a point where the government decides they want to seize, like if they ever get serious about this, taking these 401k accounts and IRA accounts and saying that some portion has to go into government bonds to ensure your retirement on your behalf, to make sure you'll have an annuity till death, which is something they've kind of kicked around, that might be a time you want to liquidate and pay the penalties just so you don't have your money tied up in a losing investment, right? And they might do it to bail the country out. My gut always has been on that particular topic, they can't do it with the existing money. People would literally tear down the walls of the Capitol building. It would make Greece look like a day at the Disney park. It really would. It would be a revolution in the streets, the likes of which you've never seen before. If they told people the money so what they would do then is they would create, they'd say all contributions to existing accounts are grandfathered, except there'll be no more contributions. These things are now shelved. So you can manage them all you want. You can do whatever you want. Going forward, 401ks, 403bs, et cetera, will work under this new model, whatever that new model is. They do that, you think about it, but you're probably still okay. If you get to a point where you need the money more than you need it for your retirement, that's really what it comes down to. If you need it to survive, then by all means, it's your money. Take it. Just really be judicious with when that actually happens. If you can struggle through, struggle through. Do not borrow it. The people that borrow from their own, unless you have a guaranteed sum of money coming, and you're covering a gap, a 90-day gap. You could, that would make sense to borrow from your own account. If you are struggling so you borrow, there's no way you're going to pay it back. There's absolutely no way that you're going to be able to repay your retirement account in 90 days, 6 months, whatever the allowance is, if you are struggling financially and you take out any significant amount of money. If it was $1,000, you could probably pay it back. And if you didn't, it's not that huge of a loss. You pay the penalty. You could use the funds themselves to pay the penalty. So if it was a small loan, fine. But when people tell me stuff like, well, I'm going to borrow $10,000 out of my account until I find a job, and they don't even have a job yet, you know, it's just not going to work. So if you've depleted your savings, for instance, and you've got a new job, but maybe you don't get paid for the first 2 weeks, and your first check is going to be backfilling, and you can sit down with a spreadsheet, work the numbers out, you might take a loan in that instance. But otherwise, you're better off with liquidation. Now, when do you just liquidate it all? I would say it almost doesn't make sense to do it unless you believe that we have a complete total economic collapse beginning, and you want to take the funds and buy whatever you can in a tangible asset with it. And we're not there yet. We're not there yet. Will we get there? Someday I think we will. I hope we never do. I don't know when, but that's what you're looking for. So you're looking for your personal indicators. I'm not a financial advisor. I can't tell you. This is just my general thoughts on it. Hope that answers your question. Let's take another one.
Hello, Jack. This is Eric, the urban survivalist in Florida. Thanks for discussing the CUCV vehicles. I'd like to know what you think about buying used military Humvees. My questions are, where can they be purchased from? What are some common problem mechanical areas to look for? Where can we get parts for them? Can they be legally registered by VIN number and legal to drive on the street? Do they have ignition keys and lockable doors? What are the reliability and mechanical differences between Humvees and Hummer H1 diesels? Can one bypass the used vehicle market and buy a new Humvee directly from the manufacturer? Also, what do you think our soldiers' reactions would be when they see civilians running around in vehicles that are indistinguishable from their own, both in peacetime and in a martial law scenario? Thank you.
Well, at first I was pretty sure the answer was simply, you can't do it, they don't sell them, and it's sort of the answer. First of all, they do not meet DOT safety requirements, so it would require significant modification of a military-grade Humvee to make it suitable for the road. There's a lot of dissimilarities between the civilian models and the military models. It's almost like trying to compare the Monte Carlo that a stock car driver drives to the Monte Carlo that you would buy from Chevrolet and drive. I don't even know if they make the Monte Carlo anymore, but you get the point. And it's not that they're enhanced for speed or anything. It's just that it's more they appear very similar. But just I would say just about every component is unique to the space. So they're very, very different. They're going to be a civilian model is going to obviously be built with more comfort in mind. It's going to be a lot less noisy. It's just not really anything that would really compare themselves to each other, other than the general appearance. Civilian models, as far as I know, I have. So here's the thing: I've never really looked at the civilian models. I've never been fascinated with them. I pretty much had 3 years of working on these damn things in Honduras and Panama, and really, when I left, if I never saw another Hummer again, fine. I really did not enjoy working on them. As far as common points of failure, I actually discovered a point of failure and was able to have. I was given credit for a modification, and we did it in the field, and I think they've done it like at the manufacturing level now. But the fans in the front of them, and some of the older ones, if you do find one, because there are a few that were sold, I'll get to that in a second. The fans themselves are made of plastic. They're a breakaway plastic. So that if someone got an arm or something in there, instead of losing an arm, you'd break blades off the fan. So we had these vehicles coming in Honduras with these shakes, like the almost like the motor was timed bad. And if you drove it, it wasn't bad. But when you were at idle, it was like boom, 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 just the whole vehicle wobbling. And we started finding the blades of the fans were broken. And what was happening is there were several fairly deep water fording areas. And when the Hummers were going through the water, they were shooting water up into the fan area. And the water in the fan area was enough volume to create enough resistance that it was actually causing the safety feature in the fan to work, and some of the blades were snapping off the fans. And once one would snap off, it would probably dangle around in there, maybe hit two. You'd end up with two blades missing on the fan. The fan was completely unbalanced now, so the vehicle vibrated as though it wasn't timed properly. So that was a point of failure. I saw not a ton, but a common thing was to have fuel pumps need to be replaced, and that's an expensive part, and it's a somewhat involved job. You got to get it right. It's not hard, but it is a little bit complicated, I guess, to make sure that the timing's right. Then the place that they fail all the time is the gaskets for the valve covers. Now, I don't know in 25 years if somebody's figured out a better way to do this, but in most vehicles, your valve covers, they go onto the motor heads over the valves, and that's where the oil's up in there in the valves, right? And that's so the oil stays in there and everything stays lubricated. And almost every engine that you'll ever put valve covers on, there's like a paper or a material gasket of some kind, and you put some sealant on both sides of the head, and then on the cover, and your piece of material goes in between there, and then that bolts down onto there. The Humvees, for some reason, I guess because it's easier to carry a tube of schmutz with you than it is to actually carry the actual gaskets, were designed so that there is no material gasket. It's just a sealant that's used. Well, when that sealant goes bad, and it does quite often, then the oil starts to leak out, and you get oil. One, you lose oil pressure. Two, you're losing oil, so you have to keep adding oil until you can fix this. And three, if it gets really bad, it becomes, you know, a deadline issue is what we call it, where if it's actually dripping oil, you've got a real problem. Not to mention you get smoke burning off the manifold and all this stuff. So you have to fix this. It's not hard, but again, it's complicated. There's a tunnel cover between the two seats, and you have to remove that. The problem is the injector lines, the fuel injector lines, are very, very tight across the top of the valve covers. And you have to take and disconnect all the fuel lines, and several of them have to be disconnected from, like, sitting in the driver's seat or passenger seat on the back side because the motor sits far back into the firewall. When you're doing that, you absolutely cut the hell out of your hands. And then when you go and you make your nice bead of sealant and you have to slide it back over there, you have to have somebody else hold the fuel lines, and it's almost inevitable that you're not going to get the sealant perfectly beaded the way you would like it because you're going to hit it on something as you put it back into here. It was a very poorly designed design as far as I'm concerned, and that's one of my bigger concerns with Hummers. That said, you get 5 or 6 tubes of that stuff and you got enough for the life of your vehicle, right? So there are some available. In 1999, the Marine Corps sold some. I'll give you a page. They were sold. Some of them were complete scrap, and some of them were in great shape. Some were sold as little as $17, which I guess would be completely scrap, and some were sold for about $20,000. You say, can you register them and put them on the road? You can do anything. I'm sure if you went through and spent tens of thousands of dollars in modifications, you could bring it up to code. Personally, I wouldn't do it. I personally would not recommend somebody go with a military-grade Humvee. As far as our soldiers being concerned about the vehicles being indistinguishable, that wouldn't be the case unless you did it intentionally. Because if you notice when military vehicles drive around, they do not have registrations, inspections, or license plates. They simply have a company number on the front of them, and that's it. Because they don't require them. So the very fact that your vehicle is displaying license plates, has a registration sticker, and that type of thing would make it immediately distinguishable. There's still a lot of Cuckvees in service, and those things are still available, like we talked about on the show. If you really wanted something tough, hardcore, because I'm going to tell you that I think that right now, if you found a really well rebuilt, cleaned up, nice, in good shape, ready to go Hummer, you're probably going to pay $30,000 or $40,000 for it, based on the limited availability and maybe more. If you wanted it for collector value and you had the funds, that's fine. If you wanted a tough vehicle, you could look at the Deuce and a Half and the 5 tons. The M35A2 Deuce and a Halves are a manual transmission. They're a little bit smaller of a cargo truck, but they're very tough. They're very easy to work on. Almost anything that goes wrong with them is easily repaired. So they're one option that makes a lot of sense. The M800, M900 series 5 tons, they have some more mechanical issues to worry about, but if you want a truck that you could actually turn into a mobile fighting platform, I mean, you could turn it into a mobile fortress, and you want it to do anything and everything you can think of, and you want it to have power, and you want it to go where other things can't go, those trucks will do it. There's a couple things to watch out for with them. One of the bigger issues is that there's this valve, we used to call it a UFO, that's like a fail-safe valve for the fail-safes on the brakes. So basically, the brakes on these trucks are air brakes. So if the air system fails, you have no brakes. So what they have are these fail safes behind the brake drums, where if the air pressure system dies, the vehicle just stops itself. The brakes are applied. And once they're applied, you couldn't move it if you want to. All right? So there's these little bolts inside these drums, and you take the bolt out, you stick it in there, and then you turn that bolt, and it'll pull the brake back off and release the brakes. You have to do that to all of the fail safes, so then you can tow the vehicle for repair. That's how it's designed to work. Well, this valve that controls this universal valve, like I said, we call it a UFO, has these seals in it, and those seals at times may dry out if the vehicle's not used a lot. And if that happens, the fail safes will go into place. And many times there's nothing wrong other than that valve. There's quite a few fittings. It would probably take me a little bit to remember how to do it, but I did dozens and dozens of them back in the day. You take the valve out, you take it apart, and you're not supposed to. You're supposed to order a new valve. You have to wait, right? So what we would do, take them out, we would grease up all the seals, oil up all the seals, and put them back on there, and it, you know, 99 times out of 100, the vehicle would be fine and serviceable. We'd then go ahead and order the valve. We would keep it in our inventory as long as we could before we'd actually swap it out and try to keep some extra ones around. We also found that in emergency situations, sometimes simply removing the airlines and spraying a whole bunch of WD-40 in there and then charging it back up would work, and you'd still want to take it apart and do a rebuild. So that's one of the bigger issues with them. All of these vehicles really need their air cleaner serviced often when they're used in dusty environments, but they're tough as nails. And you can get a really nice, completely rebuilt, beautiful 5-ton, like an M800 series, long wheelbase cargo truck for about $16,000. I'll put a link to a site that sells them today. They're a Cummins, motor. I mean, they're just awesome. And if I was going to spend money on something that I wanted to be like a military grade piece of equipment that I wanted to be tough, I would probably buy that before I'd spend $30,000-$40,000 on a Hummer, which is much more labor intensive and much more expensive in maintenance, and much less capable, when it comes to, you know, really having power. The deuce and a halves, you can get those really nicely rebuilt for about $12,000. The only thing with it, and they have less problems than the 5-ton. They're easier to maintain in the 5-ton, but they're a manual transmission. So in a shit, you know, just like we had Top call in and say, well, what happens when you can't so if everybody in the family is comfortable driving a standard transmission or was willing to learn, okay, they're fine. But then we got another point. Now we got a clutch, right? The automatic transmissions in those 5-tons, boy, they're expensive. But if you rebuild one or get a truck that has a rebuilt one, I mean, they go forever with almost no maintenance other than changing the transmission fluid. You have a deuce and a half, you have a point of that clutch is going to, clutches are designed to wear out. So it's 6 of 1/2 dozen of the other. Deuce and a half will fit a lot of places. The bigger M800, M900 series trucks won't. They're a much bigger truck. So those are just my thoughts on some military stuff in general. Maybe I should get Tim from Old Grouch on. I guess I went on for about 11 minutes there. It'll make the show longer. But I'll get Tim on maybe to talk about those instead of just CUCVs. Let's take another call.
Hey, Jack. Josiah Wallingford here. I was just listening to episode 806, and I noticed some of your comments were edited out. I could understand why you would edit out some of those comments for the open air. But I really wanted to hear them, and I'm a member of the Member Support Brigade, and I was wondering if we could, as a member of the Member Support Brigade, get access to the unedited audio files. That's all I have. Love the show. Thanks.
Well, I went back and I looked up that episode, because occasionally I might edit something out, but that was an episode called Freedom and Liberty in a World of Tyranny. And I don't think I edited anything out of there. Now, I was dealing with some throat issues around the time, so if there's anything that I edited it out, it might have been a little bit of a phlegm episode or something, but I just don't think there was anything removed from there. And I'll tell you that when you listen to an episode of Survival Podcast, that 99.9% of things that I say or anybody else says are left in. About the only editing that I've done is occasionally I've removed the F word from an episode where I really didn't think it was necessary and didn't add anything to the conversation. There was one time I did that when I was on the highway and I thought I was going to get rear-ended and there was nowhere for me to go. And you hear the tire screeching and all, I edited out the F word. When the F word's there, I have to legitimately put the explicit tag on iTunes. So sometimes when a guest comes on, like Paul Wheaton, you know, and he says that I let it go, or Jacob from Early Retirement Extreme, I let it go. I really prefer, and I generally ask my guests not to do it so that I don't have to tag the episodes as explicit. I do use some profanity, but I consider it to be moderate, mild profanity with a purpose and a point. If such a thing existed, if there were unedited versions of the show that had things that were removed because of some issue, I think that maybe I would make those available. The other thing that happens sometimes is, and you'll notice there's an edit, you can tell sometimes when there's an edit, because it'll be like, well, you know, blah, 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 and it just kind of doesn't transition well. There's occasional times where I just blow it. And fortunately for me, I'm not on live radio, and I figure you don't want to hear me say, oh, that was completely wrong, and back up and restate everything just slightly differently, and it would be wasting your time. So it just doesn't exist, or I would be happy to if there was like an adult version or something. But I just generally record things the way that I want, and I say what I think, and if you don't like it, I don't really care. I mean, so it's just not there. Anyway, fair question. Let's take another call.
Jack. Carson from Canada here. I was at the store looking for a G-type bulb, which turns out to be nigh on to impossible to find, which is another story entirely. But I happened to cross Armor Bulb, Safety Eco CFL. Note the very specific wording there, not Eco-Safe CFL, Safety Eco CFL. A safer CFL for children, elderly, pets, pregnant women, and others. Because it has a safety coating, so it looks more like a real bulb, and it's got a safety coating, so we've got just a little bit more to break before the mercury gets all over the place. Yeah. I wonder if it's possible for these people to smoke any more frickin' crack before they die of overdose. Like, seriously? Like, what are they gonna come up with next? I just don't know. These people are morons, and, well, calling them retards is an insult to retards because, well, they're not quite as smart as mentally challenged people. Anyways, hope you have a great day, and bye.
Well, there's the sarcastic Carson call, and basically Carson gets leeway to do that once in a while because he's called in with so many great calls. I don't know if I would have even put that on from a first-time caller, but from Carson I will. And Carson, in the words of one of the former presidents of the United States, I feel your pain, man. I feel your pain. And I'm not a very good Clinton impersonator, but that's who that's supposed to be. I'll actually tell you what I think about the safe CFLs now, and what Carson's talking about looks like a normal light bulb. And the little wormy bulb is inside. It's kind of like a plastic on the outside. I think, in fact, I know, that when CFLs first came out, one of the big objections people had to them is they look stupid. Especially when you put them like in like a ceiling fan where you have like the sconces and they're open. So those were originally made so you could get a CFL, but it would look like a normal light bulb. So it didn't look stupid sitting up there in your ceiling fan. Then someone in marketing, when this whole mercury thing came up, said, ah, we'll put the word safe CFL on there because it wasn't fooling anybody in the first place. We'll take this thing that was already manufactured, already exists, and we'll market it differently. And, you know, in the words of one of the people that hates CFLs passionately and the subsidies around them, Mr. Wheaton, who I'm mentioning a lot today, it seems like, no, that's just marketing. And that's exactly what you're looking at there. It's marketing of a feature that was built for one reason, for another. So it's really not them smoking crack. It's them, which I think some of those people are. But I'll tell you, I think it's just simply that they addressed one need and figured out how to market it a little bit differently. And who knows? It probably sells bulbs. Anyway, let's take another call.
Hi, Jack. This is Joe from Kansas. I just wanted to ask what your thoughts are on small tractors. I just purchased one from my grandpa. And I'm amazed at what a survival tool it can be. I mean, you can put generators on these things, wood splitters, wood chippers. I put a garden in. I mean, it's an amazing tool. I'm bouncing around in your podcast trying to catch up with the new ones and the old ones. So you might have done it already and I might have missed it. But I guess I was just wondering what you think. And thanks for the show. Take care.
Oh, it's a great question, and I'm going to tell you that if my property was a little bit different in nature, I would definitely have one. We were at Office Max, Office Depot, Office something, Staples, I don't know, whatever the one damn place they have in this podunk town is for office supplies of any size or relevance the other day. And in the parking lot was a little Kubota tractor. And I'm seldom envious of anybody. I just try not to be that kind of person. But when I looked at that little machine, it had a front-end bucket loader on the front and a backhoe blade on the back. And it was just a beautiful piece of equipment. Nice PTO, like you're saying, where you can run trippers and shredders and generators and all kinds of things with them. It ran on diesel. It wasn't very big. You could easily haul it with even a compact pickup truck would have towed the trailer that this thing was sitting on. You probably could have towed it with a car with a hitch ball. And the versatility is amazing, and I think they have a real place on any type of homestead, especially with open, more farmable type land. I have this area where there's only a very small portion of my property I could probably even drive the thing safely on, and it's all forested and things like that. So I don't know that it works for me. I would love it for these last two swales I have to dig, but that would be something I'd probably rent a machine to do, because I'm just not something I'm going to use on a daily basis. I know when we stood there, I said to my wife, if we ever decide we've had enough of this mountain life, and we decide, you know, let's go find that 20 acres that's more suitable for farming, we would have to have one of those. What I'm looking for in my situation that I think provides a lot of versatility is like the mule-style ATVs. And I think that's better for my situation, but I think a tractor is better for most homesteads. By the way, I've got this camper we purchased. It's a Shamrock 21SS. It is a beautiful camper. We've pretty much decided it doesn't fit our life. And if anybody anywhere near this place owns a good, high-quality ATV, mule style, you know, you sit in like a car, back cargo area and everything, and we'd be interested in trading one of those for a really awesome, used maybe a dozen times, brand new looking RV, hybrid, pop out. Get in touch with me. Anybody wants to buy that thing, anywhere near here that would be able to come get it, get in touch with me. They sell for about 20,000 new. I'd let it go to a listener here for 10 grand. Little sales pitch in the middle there, but it just doesn't fit. And that's the reason I bring it up though is one, I keep forgetting to bring it up because that's really not that important to me that we sell it. It's there. It doesn't hurt anything. To start thinking more in lines with, does something actually fit your lifestyle long term? So with the tractor question, look at your property. Does it make sense for your property long term? If it does, it's a great investment. If it doesn't really fit your property like it doesn't, what does? What will fill the role? So I think that for a lot of people, they're a great idea. And, you know, it just even looking at one made me kind of not just envy the machine, but envy the person that would have the land that would let the machine do what it's capable of. More and more, I think maybe we need to look for a bigger piece of land that's a little bit flatter and a little bit more in line with doing a lot more growing of things and livestock and things like that. But hey, we're pretty happy where we're at for now. It took us a long time to get here, so that's way into the future. Good question. Let's go ahead and take another one.
Hi, Jack. My name is Todd. I've recently found your show, and I've been listening to you through the MP3 or by MP3 in my cars when I work at night. One of the things that I've found that I have the most difficult time with is storing emergency food. I live in Florida, and I just don't have the room in my house. I don't have a basement. I can't store it in a shed because it gets too hot in the summer. I can't dig a hole and bury it because the water table is about at ground level. And I was just wondering if you had any ideas on how to go about storing food in a manner that economizes space. Thank you very much. I hope you consider answering my question.
It's actually kind of a quite common question I get. A lot of people that are apartment livers or have small homes and what have you and feel like, you know, where else can I put some stuff? And there's no easy answer. You only have what you have, and we all have to look at their spatial limitations and decide, with those spatial limitations, what am I going to do and what am I not going to do? For instance, we keep some stuff underneath the house because it actually stays very cool under there. And we have a mobile home, so we're able to do that. And so that's one way we've expanded where we're able to store it. If somebody breaks in or something, they're not very likely to try to go under there. And if you went under there, it's kind of difficult to maneuver and all, especially if you don't know where everything is. And let's just say you might find yourself very, very unhappy if you did and didn't know what you were doing, right? So that's, you know, that doesn't really help your question. Some of the things that we did before we moved here, and we had kind of less space because we had a kid and other kids in the house all the time and stuff. Crap and video games and, you know, stuff that we've kind of downsized on now and we have more space, is we would put stuff under the bed. And we have a very high bed, so we could fit two fairly deep, kind of the shallow, long Tupperware things full of food, all organized, and we could fit, like, since we have a king-size bed, we could fit, like, three, like, nine sectors underneath just the bed, and double stack. So that's 18, just, and it's completely unused space in a lot of situations. If your bed doesn't sit high enough, well, they make those things mainly for college students that are like these, like, pedestals that lift the bed up. So you put them there and you set the bed up on top of that. You can get longer sheets so it hangs to the floor and you just really don't even notice it. So that's one of the few places in most homes that I can think of where you can add extra stuff. And then the other thing is to be very organized with what you're doing. Do eat what you store and store what you eat. Your pantry alone, if you keep a pantry organized, even a small pantry, can hold much more food than most people think if you get organized and if you get into kind of a rotational thing, that type of thing. I really can't give you any other answers other than I can tell you there's probably places that you could use that right now are being used for something else that's not really necessary. And if you're, like, say you're in a one-bedroom apartment, keep in mind, you only have to, if you're in a one-bedroom apartment, it's either you or you and a spouse or you and a partner, you only have to save enough food for one or two people. So you don't have the same needs. Now, if you have a couple, you're in three bedrooms, now you got three beds, right? If you got three beds, a couple kids, you know, maybe Johnny and Susie, you get the closet, Daddy gets the space under your bed to make sure we have food, right? And if you take three beds worth of what I just said, that's a significant amount of food. The caveat there is make sure that you're going in and going through that stuff once a month, pulling it out, replacing it is in a rotational manner as much as you can. That's one thing you want to do. It's easy to forget about that stuff. If you want to just go the easy route for that, and you just want to, you know, just reserve food in case, and you just kind of do your deep pantry thing, then under your beds you could store true long-term storage food, Mountain House, Providing Pantry, Yoder's, Thrive, that type of stuff. So there's, you know, that's another space that you could allocate to do that with. So just get creative and think about the way that you organize things is the best advice I can give you. But the under-the-bed storage has been very helpful. Everybody that I've talked to that's tried it has said they've been really surprised at how much they could store by either lifting the bed up or if they already had a sufficient lift, just using that space as storage space. Let's take another call.
Hey, Jack. My name's Jason. I just want to let you know I was listening to a podcast. It's a little bit old now, around Thanksgiving, and you're talking about dogs. And I can tell you, I picked up a Feist last year on your recommendation, and it is the absolute greatest dog I've ever met in my life. I mean, it is a Jack Russell on steroids for certain. So I don't know. You're talking about a cur. Maybe get both, man. You know, maybe go for broke, because this dog, it was a working dog. Like, you know, its parents have lived in, you know, crates with straw on the floor for years, and I was concerned about it being an indoor dog, you know, like being a family pet. And this son of a gun, I don't care. You know, the other night there was a deer that walked out. I kid you not, there's a deer that was outside my door. I didn't know it was there, and my dog wouldn't shut up. So I finally opened the door to show him nothing was wrong, and there's an 8-point buck about 7 inches from my face. I mean, this dog, it knows what's going on. They're great little pups. So don't just throw out the Feist. You know, it's a damn good dog. And mine's actually a broken one because the stripe on its head wasn't straight. The guy shot me a deal for like $50. It's a damn good dog, man. So anyways, you know, good luck to y'all. I'm glad doing what you're doing. You know, keep keeping up the show, and I'm glad your homestead's working out for you. But anyway, go with the Feist, man. It's a great dog.
Well, it's great to hear, and we haven't written off a Feist as our next dog. One of the reasons I was thinking about a Kerr is we're thinking about putting in a fence, and if you were a prospective intruder and the house now is a perimeter fence, and inside that fence was a tough-ass Kerr dog and a 125-pound German Shepherd, you'd probably think twice before you came in there. And Kerrs are fearless. They're absolutely fearless. So it was, now we got a dog that can serve a role is, you know, and one of the greatest things to hunt in this state, because the season's like all year round almost, is squirrel. And I love to squirrel hunt. So that's one of the reasons I was attracted to the Feist. Well, the Kerr will do that, and the Kerr will also be very easily trained to do things like hunting fur bearers like raccoon. And they have a little bit better of a nose on, in some scenarios and things. But the Feist is actually very attractive as well to me. So I haven't made my mind up yet. We had gotten some bad news that our dog, Blackie, who we've had for 16 years or 15 years, was not long for the world, and he was supposed to be dead by Thanksgiving. Well, I just took him out, and he just galloped down the driveway this morning. So I'm not really in the market for a new dog. Two dogs is about as much as we can handle. We travel so much, we've almost considered maybe not getting a second dog for quite a bit after Blackie goes, and usually need a good grieving period anyway when you lose an animal that's been part of your life for that long. We're certainly not looking forward to it. We're just glad the doctor's completely wrong. Supposedly he has bladder cancer. It's terminal. There's nothing they can do. And there's a, he doesn't seem to believe that. He just seems to be going on about his business and happy and content. Part of our issue with keeping more than a couple dogs is we travel so much, so we have a boarding expense. Now, maybe once we get the fence in, I can put in a good kennel, and if the dogs could stay at the property and be looked after by neighbors when we're gone, that would make things a lot easier. And they can't be in the house because they will, you know, there's no way the neighbors are going to be there often enough to keep them from going to the bathroom in the house. And that's a something you don't want, a nice new carpet that we just put in. So it would have to be some type of a really good place where they can stay cool and or warm depending on the season, be completely secure. I know they're not going to get away and get hurt or anything like that. And then maybe we would look at maybe going to a three-dog house, but I think that's even a bit much for us. It's probably going to be two, that balance as well. Anyway, glad to hear you're having great results with the little guy. They sure have a lot going for them, and they are beautiful little dogs, and they do seem like they're very intelligent, very alert, and still very high on my list. You know, that's really what I have it narrowed down to is between the two. And if you go to Squirrel Dog Forum, there's a whole forum about guys that are squirrel hunters and their dogs. If you ask somebody that owns the Kerr, they'll say that's the way to go. And if you ask somebody that owns the Feist, they'll say that's or the Feist, that's the way to go. And that's it's I think it's just I don't think you can go wrong either way. But glad you're enjoying yours, and have a great day. Thanks for the call.
Hey Jack, this is Kevin from Texas. I have a question about combining hugel culture with fruit trees. I lost an apple tree this year during the drought in Texas, and I thought about burying. I'm going to plant several more fruit trees in the spring. I'm going to bury. I was thinking about burying some wood with them in a hugel culture style, but then I read something about root rot with fruit trees. I just want to know, is it a good idea or not? And I don't want to overthink it. So, talking about a couple logs down there when I do it, or how far should I take that? Thank you very much. Bye.
Well, the master of hugel culture would probably have to be Sepp Holzer, and he definitely does fruit trees built into hugel culture beds so that by the time the beds have kind of run their course and you're done with your annual production, the tree is now fully established. So you can certainly do it. The way I'm doing it, just to give you an idea, is I'm doing swales with hugel culture, and I'm actually planting the trees just below or right at the edge of the hugel mound, so that when the hugel mound drops down some, the tree itself is in firm ground with its roots. So I don't see any reason you can't do it. As far as rot, there's an important thing to understand about rot. Rot underground is generally more of a fungal thing. And fungus generally attack and consume that which is dead. So you can have living and dead material side by side, and the fungus will take the dead and leave the living. Almost the way that maggots will, where they use maggots sometimes with deeply infected wounds, and they put maggots on a person's arm or leg where this infected wound is, they cover them up, and then they remove them the next day, and all of the infected tissue is gone, and they don't touch. It's kind of a gross thought, but it's a similar analogy. So there's no reason you can't do it, and I certainly would do it, and it will probably help you immensely with your drought issues. The other thing is mulch, 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 mulch. I'm talking 5, 6, 10 inches of mulch in the area underneath the tree and extending beyond the drip line. The more mulch, the better. And that's not tilling it into the soil. That's just laying it on top of the ground. Good quality wood mulch would probably be the best thing for the application you're talking about. But Huaculture growing fruit trees, natural fit. Take a look at some of the stuff that Sepp Holzer's doing. I'll see if I can find the right video and give you a link to it on YouTube today so you can see what he's doing out at his Kremeter Hof with Huaculture and growing trees. Let's take another call. I think one more.
Hi, Jack. This is Joe in Oregon. I've heard you mention using a compost pile in a greenhouse for keeping the greenhouse temperature up in the winter. Or also, I've heard, I don't know if it was you or some other permaculture thing mentioning using it in conjunction with a chicken coop. I know you talked about having chickens in there. But anyway, my question was, doesn't a compost pile put off methane gas? And I haven't built a greenhouse before, but if it was airtight, would that be dangerous for going in there, or particularly if you had chickens in it? And then also, obviously, the chickens would have to get out. But then just wondering if you thought that would be an issue. Thanks.
Well, it kind of makes me think of there's this picture that's gone around the internet a few times of this gal, and she's got a gun, like a scoped gun, and it's like up over her shoulder instead of into her shoulder, and she's got her eye like pressed against the scope, and the caption underneath it says, "You are doing it wrong." And the reality is, if you're getting methane in your compost production, pretty much you're doing it wrong. And for heating a greenhouse, that type of composting would not be effective because it's not going to generate heat. There's two ways that we can break down organic material, anaerobic and aerobic. Anaerobic is with oxygen, anaerobic is lacking oxygen. If you want to make methane, you want anaerobic breakdown. So you want breakdown of the material without oxygen. So you got wet, nasty, gooey stuff without a good carbon-nitrogen ratio, and you put that into and it'll stink, and that stink is the methane. And if you did that, not only would you have a problem with filling your greenhouse with methane and maybe causing dangers to your chickens or yourself, or even maybe pops flammable danger if your greenhouse was so airtight that it stayed in there, you would not get any heat. So if you're doing the type of composting that would actually cause this to happen, you probably want to be making at least a cubic yard of compost to get this heat build up, this fast composting action that you're looking for in heating a greenhouse. You're going to have a good ratio of carbon and nitrogen, and you're going to get a quick, rapid aerobic breakdown, and that's what produces the heat. So it's not that there can't be a problem with methane. It's that normal composting, when we talk about composting, we're not creating methane. In fact, one of the biggest reasons to compost is to reduce methane into the atmosphere. People always worry about the CO2 fairy, the fairy tale nonsense that CO2 in our atmosphere is actually an issue. It's not. Large amounts of methane in our atmosphere, look at Venus. That's what a lot of methane does. Methane in the atmosphere is bad. And when we take all of these food scraps and crap like that, and we go to a landfill and we shove all that crap in there, and it's under the ground and it's covered up, well, guess what then? Once that happens, it's going to be in lack of oxygen. So when it breaks down, it's going to be an anaerobic breakdown. It's going to produce an awful lot of methane. So then we have two choices. One, it slowly permeates out of the ground into the atmosphere. Some of it does remain trapped, but some of it's going to get out. Or we can actually go into those landfills, drill down into them, and harvest and use the methane for fuel. That's a better option because when the methane is burned, it's less of a problem in the atmosphere than when it's simply released. But if the majority of suburban homeowners were to just simply set up a compost pile and start composting, and if they didn't want to compost in the conventional manner, if they started practicing vermicomposting, you'd get almost, because if you have 20 pounds of worms, they can take care of 20 pounds of food a day. And almost no one produces that much scrap material, and they will bioregulate themselves. If there's more food, they'll make more worms. If there's less food, they'll have smaller and less worms. They'll adjust to the food that's available. So between vermicomposting and conventional composting, we can actually keep a lot of methane out of the atmosphere. That's a great reason to do it. So it wouldn't cause a problem as long as you were composting properly. In fact, it's part of the solution to methane production. Now, what if you want methane? Well, then you need a sealed container. Then you create an anaerobic breakdown. And then you trap the methane, and then you use it as fuel. And you can do either or, but if you're doing an anaerobic breakdown inside a greenhouse, yes, you could have methane off-gas issues, but it's just you're doing it wrong if you do it that way. With that, we've got the show wrapped up. I really enjoyed doing this show. I hadn't done one in a long time. I may even go back into some of the older calls. I'm going to be at SHOT Show in a couple of weeks. And we have that whole week there, and I need to get some shows like Double Up next week. Maybe I'll do some Double Up on this stuff to get some of those old ones. But remember, the best thing to do if you want to be on the air next Friday, get your call in, let's say, over the weekend, Monday or Tuesday. You're probably going to be early in the queue, and if you make a good call like I told you how to do, you're probably going to get your call on the air. I do about 10 a week, so that tells you if I get 30 a week, 20 of them are going to get called out, and there's just no way around that. But maybe we'll work some extra ones in. On SHOT Show, I have a really cool announcement here at the end of today's show. If you're in Vegas or going to be there for SHOT or just are in the area and would like to participate with this, we are going to have a meetup at Tommy Bahamas on Thursday of SHOT Show Week, which I think is let me look real quick on my calendar. I would say that is probably the 19th. I will put full details out later today on the blog. Sis Wolf has it set up already on Facebook as an event. We can only take 60 people. It ain't cheap. It's like 50 bucks a plate or 60 bucks a plate or something like that. She put it together to be really, really nice. So it's probably not something you want to bring five kids to or something like that. It's a family environment you want to find, but it could add up. I think adult beverages are in the range of 10 bucks and up there, so for mixed drinks and things like that. So it's to us it's a big thing to go to SHOT Show, and we wanted to do something kind of classy and nice, but with a casual atmosphere. That's what Tommy's is. I'll publish the menu and all the details in the blog, and we'd love to see you there. Again, you'll have to go to the Facebook page, register for the events. I think we're capping it at 60 attendees. And, of course, there's myself, Dorothy, Tips, me, and TW right there. There's four, so that leaves, 56? All right, so with that, we've got the show wrapped up. Again, I enjoyed taking your calls. Hope to see some of you guys out in Vegas. Remember, check my appearances page if you want to meet me out there. I'm going to be in North Carolina in March. I'm going up to Montana with Seth Holzer. I've got the Liberty Forum in New Hampshire. I'm getting out a lot this year. I want to meet a lot of you, shake a lot of your hands, things like that. With that, this has been Jack Spirko with another episode of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
Seeing our food these days, you know it's on our TVs. Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Someday we'll realize our children just can't pay. Nobody up there cares, they're living for today. We'll be right back.
questions you